This podcast includes graphic depictions of true crime cases and may contain explicit language. Listener discretion is advised. Hey, this is Robin.
This is Jackie.
And this is Amanda.
And you are listening to We Saw the Devil, a podcast dedicated to horror, true crime, and all things macabre. If you want to follow us between shows, don't forget to check us out online. You can go to our website at www.wesawthedevil.com. You can follow us on Instagram at We Saw the Devil Podcast or on Twitter at We Saw the Devil. And if you want to follow specific co-hosts' social media, you can find the links to those on our website as well. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of We Saw the Devil. Tonight's episode is going to be a very interesting one. It's actually going to be a two-parter. So the next episode will come out next Tuesday. And we decided there's so much information about this case. You have multiple documents regarding Lori and Chad's belief systems that have come out over the last couple of weeks. And just exploring the forums, right? The Christmas Misery Group, the JJ and Tylee groups, just a lot of sites and forums dedicated to this case. There's a lot of arguments, a lot of misconceptions, a lot of fights, frankly, over Mormonism. Wouldn't you say, Amanda?
I agree. Yeah, just everywhere you look, any Vallo update of any kind, whether it be news, YouTube, even just random, you know, the Facebook groups, anything turns into an argument. Mm-hmm. Or some sort of, no, you're being disrespectful to LDS, or no, that's LDS teachings. All of them think this. Mm-hmm. And it's just not fair to anyone involved.
And I can honestly sit back on the sideline and say that I am unaffected by this because I am atheist. And I don't like the amount of disrespect that has been taking place. So regardless of your own personal beliefs, I think it behooves us to be respectful to our fellow man. Mm-hmm. You know, approach this case with more of like an analytic lens rather than personal opinions. I like to try to delve into facts. So we decided with the 7 missions to accomplish together email that Chad sent Lori, as well as the document that supposedly Ian Pawlowski cobbled together outlining Chad and Lori's beliefs, we decided to bring on a longtime member of the LDS Church to discuss this with us and how these beliefs align with traditional and accepted LDS teachings.
Yeah. And I think it'll be very helpful.
Yeah, I think it will be very, very helpful. I feel like it was certainly a learning experience for me. I grew up personally in the South, and I went to a private school that was Christian-backed, and I can confess that I am completely ignorant to the Mormon faith.
Yeah, I've gotten the opportunity to interview a couple people when I was in Rexburg and, you know, play 20 questions with them. But I still don't think that I fully understand. Obviously, I don't fully understand everything that they believe. So I still have a ton of questions.
So we brought on our friend Ian Murphy, a longtime member of the Mormon Church. He's also a writer, a producer, also a broadcaster. And he actually took the time, was kind enough to go pretty much like statement through statement of the documents with us and how that aligns with LDS doctrine, which was incredibly helpful. So for this episode, you're going to hear part 1, and then next Tuesday, you're going to hear part 2 of that. So before we get into our interview, we have a couple Lori Vallo updates this week. Minor things, nothing, you know, mind-blowing. I think this is the first time, Amanda, since we've started the Lori Vallo case, where there wasn't an update as we were recording so far.
We are still recording, so that can change in like 5 minutes.
But we have a couple updates there. Before that, though, again, I would like to thank our Patreons for helping make this possible. We have Amy, Derek, Ian, Iris, Nikki, and Shauna. And then Shauna, Ian, and Iris being the executive producers of the show. Really, really super appreciate it. Again, if you enjoy the show, want t-shirts, merch, from an angle of supporting us and helping us make this better and putting out a product that you enjoy, please consider becoming a patron. You can find us at patreon.com/WeSawTheDevil. And we offer a lot of things like merch, stickers, shout outs.
A lot of cool stuff. We're also always looking at adding stuff to it too. So just because, you subscribe to it now doesn't mean that you may not get additional, you know, additional gear in the future.
You'll also be receiving occasional mystery packages. That's not creepy at all.
So for those that we'll try to keep it not creepy.
Try to.
But for those that did receive your packages, I've gotten a couple pictures sent in our private Patreon group. However, if you want to add it to Instagram or Twitter or even Facebook and make it public and then tag the hashtag WSTDgear, we want to share some of our favorites. So again, we've gotten some in our private group, but if you want to make it public, we'd love to share pictures of your gear.
Indeed. And the big news last week, too, is that we are starting a new case. So we've been covering Lori Vallow. We will continue to cover Lori Vallow updates as they happen. But we are going to be starting a new case. So we will be doing a full season on one of the most evil and prolific criminals the United States has ever endured. The amount of pain and suffering that this man has inflicted upon thousands of innocent people is quite frankly unimaginable. His crimes have earned him many monikers. He's also known as the Cordova Cat Burglar, the Visalia Ransacker, the Night Stalker, which was then eventually changed to the original Night Stalker to differentiate him from Richard Ramirez, who we have discussed at length as well on this show. Also known as the Diamond Knot Killer, the East Area Rapist, and the Golden State Killer. Now, the true numbers may never be known, but with 13 confirmed murders, over 200 burglaries, and 50 rapes, he spent years terrorizing the suburbs of California. And his name is Joseph James D'Angelo. And now, I've personally been fascinated with this case for over 10 years. I've spent, like, God, at least over 1,000 hours on the pro boards. I've actually personally spoken with Michelle McNamara before she unfortunately passed away. And just so much has been written about him. Other podcasts have covered him, obviously. But we decided to really do a deep dive into every single aspect of this case. Not only the ones that he's being tried for or indicted for, but the ones that are also attributed to him as well. So we're going to discuss every single attack, his MO, the DNA evidence, the psychological profiles, and everything up to and including his long-awaited arrest on April 24th of 2018. So stay tuned as that first episode in the series is going to drop. It did get pushed back. Because we had this amazing opportunity to speak with Ian. To understand Lori Vallow, we'll do anything.
Right? Well, try to understand. I don't think anyone can fully understand. No. But yeah, that case is very interesting, not only because it's so horrific, but also it is still ongoing. So just like Lori Vallow, as things happen, we'll be able to, you know, sit back and watch the hearings unfold and follow along as everything continues.
We certainly will. So stay tuned for that. And let's get into the couple of Lori Vallow updates this week.
Yeah. So like you said, they're kind of updates, some speculation. And then I think one of them is pretty good. But this week has been kind of a dry week for Vallow.
I think that we have to first discuss that there was a 6.5 magnitude earthquake in Idaho today.
That is true.
You know, I'm sure that her group is very excited about that.
I don't know. They could have prepared it for all we know.
I wonder if the portal opened.
I mean, yeah, to keep them safe. I'm sure they moved before it happened. Oh, my gosh. Anyways, yeah. So there was that earthquake. Hoping everyone's okay. So all of our friends in Rexburg, I hope all of you are fine. As far as just a couple little things, some speculation this week. Annie Cushing. So we all know Annie Cushing by now, I hope. She posted in one of the Vallow groups that she was speculating that Alex may be gay. And she had a couple little points to it. And I think the reason she's bringing this up is because she's also, like us, trying to understand why Alex did Lori's bidding. Like, what made this bond so strong? Now, I know, Robin, you've brought up that you thought it was incest. And Annie Cushing says she doesn't believe that's the case. She believes he was gay. And the reason why it even matters, because, you know, it really shouldn't, is that Lori might have not been a fan of that. I guess there was at some point a fight where neighbors remember Lori screaming that he brought disgrace on the family, which is incredibly sad. And then also there's a clip of Alex's stand-up where he says, "You guys look good, makes me wish I was straight." Now, stand-up, obviously comedy. It could have just been a weird joke. And I want to tread lightly on this because obviously it shouldn't matter.
I would like to state for the record that homophobia is not welcome on this show. And if you are homophobic, then we don't want you listening to this show because we do not accept that in any capacity.
Agreed. Yes. So with that being said, I'm just going off of the speculations. Now, she also says that that might have been why he married Zulema too. And that's kind of just the timeline of things. It would help make a little bit of sense. But again, this could just be a stretch. It's just something circulating. I guess other people have speculated on it too. And she was just bringing it to the attention, trying to make sense of things.
Yes. And she did not, the way that she wrote it, it was not malicious or trying to spread rumors. No. It was literally addressing the fact that people had brought it up and that a video of him doing stand-up did surface. And then the fight that he and Lori had in the street, apparently. It was very loud in the street. Neighbors have commented on it.
Yeah.
Also, the fact, I believe that Annie Cushing did confirm that Lori herself was vehemently anti-gay.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. So that's one thing that's circulating. I don't know if that really makes, like, I mean, if she says you're bringing disgrace on the family and then he has to marry this random woman, I don't know how that fixes anything. Or honestly, why it would make him her hitman. I don't know.
The relevance of
it. I don't know if that really falls in line. Yeah. So that's just something that I've seen shared quite a bit lately in a lot of the groups. So wanted to just touch on it. Another kind of awesome thing that happened is Lamar Advertising donated two billboards with pictures of the missing kids. So one is, from my understanding, on the highway to Yellowstone. Again, I've only visited once. I don't know all of the highways. And then one is near Rexburg, mm-hmm. too. So that's cool that they'll be up for at least 2 months and it was donated.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Now, last but not least, this is the update that I honestly was excited to see. So there was an email from Chandler PD that got released. And in this email, it says, "We continue to work on Charles's case," and Charles being Charles Vallow, "and are confident we are getting closer to getting Lori indicted for her involvement in Charles's death." So they're finally looking at Lori.
Thank God. It is about time, because I feel like, okay, and this ties in, right, to some of the digital evidence. Remember when it was a big deal where they said that they had digital evidence? Like the FBI, I believe, is the one that put out that they have digital evidence leading to basically like sinister plans or whatever. Do not quote me on that, but that is more or less what they said, is digital evidence of, you know, intent to commit a crime.
Right. And I think that was with Tammy
as
well.
I think they actually called it a web. I think they actually used the word web. So I wonder if, you know, some of this is finally coming into fruition. And then, you know, they met in what, Salt Lake City a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
Probably it's been speculated that the Tammy Daybell autopsy results are back. So I wonder if now is kind of go time in the background here.
Right. And I don't know how much stuff is on the back burner because of what's going on everywhere currently. But I do hope that at least that's moving along, because I still feel awful for her family, too. Just I don't think that that was natural at all. Another piece to the story, though, is, of course, our friend Justin Lum posted this not too long ago. And they also talked to Cheryl Wheeler as well about Vallow's death. And she was his ex-wife, so the mother to his other children, or his children. She basically said that Alex would have at least passed out if hit with a bat by her brother. Because remember, he was an ex-ball player. I'm sure it wouldn't just be a little tap. Especially if it was self-defense. You would think that there'd be some crazy wound to justify killing a man. I feel like I could hit someone with a bat and it'd be more severe. And that's not much.
There would be something noticeable, at least, most likely.
Yeah, or ongoing, you know, like concussion, just something. So that's a little bit of a Vallow update. Again, it's not big, it's not life changing. However, it does show that people are still working behind the scenes to, you know, get some stuff done.
It's true. It is ongoing. Hopefully, I have a feeling my gut instinct, which isn't probably worth much, but is telling me that there is going to be a pretty big breakthrough coming in the next week or two.
Are you a prophet now?
I'm a translated being. Shut up.
Well, good. Then you don't need your snacks anymore then. Your end of the world snacks. Anyways, yeah, with that being said, I really do hope everyone is safe and healthy and staying home. Just the news stories have been awful, so try to look at some of the good that's happening too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, so other than that, keep in mind, we're going to go ahead and air our discussion with Ian. Keep in mind that we were on different platforms, so as far as audio quality, it may be a little bit mismatched.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we did have to record on a different platform than our usual. So with that being said, if there is any interruptions or strange sounds, we apologize, but we wanted to get this information out to you.
Mm-hmm. Alrighty, so we are going to go ahead and air this interview in part one. So we are really excited today to bring on a friend of the show, an executive producer of We Saw the Devil, writer, broadcaster, and member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Ian Murphy. So Ian, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. This has been a very controversial topic in a lot of different forums and groups and whatnot, and we really appreciate your generosity and willingness to come on and kind of discuss this with us.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm very happy to. It's not only is it a complex case with complex theology and belief systems involved, but getting three people to sit around and agree on any point of religion is hard to start with. So it's understandable that there are a lot of questions and people, you know, wrestling with trying to understand what do Chad and Laurie and other people involved in the case believe. What does the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints believe, and where do all of these things fit together and intersect, and what are the tensions that come from that?
And I also, for full transparency, I feel very lucky in the sense that Ian and I have been friends for quite a while now, and you know, coming into this case and Lori Vallow case and exploring the forums, you see a lot of comments about the church of the LDS Church and a lot of murkiness for a lot of people surrounding which beliefs belong where, which ones are more, you know, related to expressions of Mormonism and so forth. And so I've been very lucky. Ian and I have had incredible conversation kind of on the side about this case as a whole and keeping up and, you know, with the news and findings that come out weekly. And so I really appreciate Ian's perspective and lens. I feel like I can view this case in a more thorough way, I guess, from multiple perspectives. Ian, do you mind would you like to describe your Mormon experience? Because I know that with this church, people can have just such vastly different experiences.
Thank you. So I joined the LDS Church when I was in my early 20s. I come from a very broadly painted picture Christian background, but not any particular denomination, really. So I joined in my early 20s, and it's strange to think that that's nearly 25 years ago. So more of my life has been in the church than was before I joined the church. I'm an active member in a local leadership position, but I do have some unconventional thinking on some issues or some aspects, which is normal in any church, right? We tend to think of Mormons or Catholics or Jews or any form of religion as being this sort of monolithic belief group. But we see that in all religions, there's the official doctrine, but there are people within that who will believe this or that or this part of it or so forth. So, but my goal here is to emphasize what are the teachings of the church, what are the doctrines of the church. But I'm not here as a representative of the church. And some of the things, you know, that I say, it's the point is to be clear about what does the church teach and what message do they put out and what are those doctrines. I married into the heart of the church, really. I married a wonderful woman who's from what we call pioneer stock, those early Mormon families that crossed the plains to get to Utah and to establish somewhere there. And so she's from a very strong and large, active LDS family, you know, that goes sort of seven generations back in the church. I joined the church when I was living in England, and I moved to the US 10 years ago. I lived in Utah for most of that time, and I've lived in Las Vegas for the last 18 months. But it gives me a couple of interesting different perspectives there on LDS issues, that sense of being an immigrant, but also someone who's married in and converted in to the church and into a church family. So it does give me a different lens to look at things through. I also have a lot of critical thinking skills, I think, and I'm not very good at accepting things just because they're taught or just because you're told so. And that has helped give me a different perspective on things and to look mm-hmm. for answers, to ask questions in a different manner.
No, that's all good background too. Thank you.
As far as your Mormon experience, Ian, do you attend LDS services currently?
Yes, I attend. Well, at the moment, due to the coronavirus, because we're not church services.
Good.
But
good.
Yeah, I'm an active member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and my wife and I both hold callings and responsibilities within our ward and leadership position and so forth.
Has anyone been discussing the Lori Vallow case around you and your circles?
No, not at all. Which I found really strange once I started, you know, reading up on the case and getting interested in it. And most people, when I've asked them about it, haven't even heard of Chad, for example.
Really?
He's not somebody who is terribly well known in mainstream Mormon circles to start with. There are a couple of people who I know where I've seen on Facebook mentioning the case, and I've reached out to them to discuss a little. But there's been very little talk about it here, at least, you know, in Las Vegas.
And that is something that you and I have discussed in one of our many conversations as well, is that it seems that Julie Rowe is actually the more notable personality or writer in the church, right? Which blew my mind, to be honest with you.
My experience and understanding is that Julie Rowe was a lot better known before this broke. I think one of those reasons is the fact that she is a woman prophetess, or declaring herself to be a prophetess. And that is incredibly unusual in LDS circles, in LDS history. So it marks her out for attention in a different way. She's more unique, whereas, you know, the things that Chad writes about and talks about and the perspective that he comes from is more common.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of kind of what Chad believes then, I'm not sure if you've seen it, but did you see his 7 missions that he had sent to Lori? And did you have any input on what he might have meant? I have them in front of me, too.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so remember then, just for those listening, Chad emailed this to Lori. It doesn't have any context, so we've speculated before, but we wanted to get, of course, Ian's input, too. So it's called The 7 Missions to Accomplish Together. The first one is translate ancient records.
This is something that's really interesting in how it fits to the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that with the Book of Mormon, which is an additional book of scripture that we read alongside the Bible. And the idea goes that we have historically the scattering of the 10 tribes of Israel, and that Christ came to this earth and taught over in Jerusalem, right? And we're familiar with his story, you know, from Bethlehem and Nazareth and all of those places, but that's a fairly narrow geographic area. And so the idea goes that Christ has this gospel for the whole planet. And if the only place that he taught was in that small geographic area, that's not very helpful for getting the gospel out to the whole world. So we believe that after his resurrection, taught in other places, including in the Americas. And the Book of Mormon, part of what it details is Christ's mission and teachings in the Americas, which really they reinforce what's taught in the Bible. There are a lot of similarities, a lot of commonalities. They hang together very well. So the Book of Mormon is an example of an ancient record that we believe Joseph Smith translated. And therefore, it makes sense that there will be Latter-day Saints who believe that there are other ancient records that may need translating. So it sounds to me when I read that, that perhaps Chad and Laurie believe they have access to or will have access to other ancient records that will be in need of translation.
That number one was pretty, I would say, the main item that we were confused about. So that definitely provides a good bit of context for that, and we really appreciate that. Following up on that, number two is write the book about the translation process. So is that kind of a natural offshoot of number one, of just kind of outlining the way, the manner in which they would do that?
Not necessarily. Hmm. I mean, that's the obvious conclusion, right? Hey, this is, we were inspired, we did this, however, but it really depends what they're talking about with translation here. When we get down to point number six, we see ordain individuals to translation as the camps begin. So translation can mean something else completely different, and it could be that they're referring to that. Translation is a, translated beings are, we believe, are persons who are changed so that they don't experience pain or death until their resurrection to immortality. I know that sounds like a bit of word soup, but this refers to what are believed to be a very small number of righteous individuals, such as Enoch and Moses and Elijah, John the Baptist, and three men who are referred to as the three Nephites. And so it's a very... there may be one or two others, but it's a very small number of people who have said they'll never taste death, things like that. And this, you know, takes you into Old Testament and New Testament and Deuteronomy, where it talks about, you know, nobody knowing where Moses was buried and things like that. So it is possible that when they're saying, write the book about the translation process, that they're not talking about books at that point, but they're talking about how individuals are translated.
Wow.
And this could tie into some of their other unorthodox beliefs.
I never read it like that. And that makes total sense, because yes, she talked about being a translated being. I think we talked about last week.
Yes. And then, which I can't wait until we get into Ian Pawlowski's outline that he created, because this is all starting to kind of tie and tick together. So,
yeah, that makes way more sense than what we had speculated on. So thank you for that.
So number four is something that also pops up on another document that we'll be covering here shortly, but Presidency of the Church of Firstborn.
This refers to a pretty obscure scripture. And as with the Bible, you know, there are areas that people tend to read more regularly or spend less time in. And this is a fairly obscure piece that I had to do a bit of rooting around and checking on. The LDS Church teaches that the Church of the Firstborn refers to those who will be exalted come the Second Coming, not something that's relevant to people today. However, there are some interesting other meanings for it, and that is a couple of Mormon expressions have taken on that name. So that is these, you know, fringe groups who believe that they are the rightful church now, such as the one founded by the LeBaron family, and there's also a Fred Collier group that ties into the LeBaron family to some degree, but seems to be a separate thing. So there are some existing Mormon expressions that call themselves the Church of the Firstborn to start with. And given what we saw in the manifesto that came from Ian's computer, and that sense of Chad and Laurie being part of a larger group, makes me question if that is a connection to one of these Churches of the Firstborn. Mm-hmm. And that might be, or a similar group might be what they're referring to there.
that makes sense. And also, I would like to stop because you did use the word expression. And this is something that you taught me that I was not aware of previously. Can you just, for our listeners, describe what an expression is? Maybe just define it?
Oh, thank you. Yes. And I apologize for the use of terminology there that can be a little distant. You know, sometimes we don't know how to describe these sort of splinter groups or fractions or people that break away. And sometimes the term cult can be appropriate and sometimes not. And so, you know, people look for an umbrella term to kind of describe a group that has been heavily influenced by LDS teaching, but is not part of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Mm-hmm. But because they're stems from that source, they are an expression of Mormonism. Mm-hmm. It's something that's expressed itself, or a belief system that's expressed itself, coming from that same shared wellspring. And so that's where the term comes from, of these groups as being expressions of Mormonism.
Thank you. I really appreciate you defining that. I myself had no idea what proper terminology to use initially, so I appreciate that little nugget of wisdom there. Now, how does the hierarchy of the church itself view expressions? Are they all viewed equally? Are some accepted? Are some disavowed? How do expressions fit in with the greater church?
I think that really it depends what we're talking about in terms of how an expression functions and what it does. If an expression is leading people away from the LDS Church and its teachings, then that would be considered apostate behavior and can be grounds for excommunication and can be problematic. Mm-hmm. I think that there is some space for expressions that may be in addition to LDS theology, mm-hmm. but not necessarily a contradiction. So I know we'll talk about energy healing more down the line. If you take that in its broadest sense, I could include things like Reiki, touch healing and different things. If you had an expression that was just tacking on that piece to Mormonism, to conventional LDS theology, that might not be a problem. What is interesting to me in this, though, is how expressions are really rooted into the origins of Mormonism. Mm-hmm. Joseph Smith, as the founder of the church, started the LDS church as an expression of Christianity, we might say. Europe had gone through the Reformation and that sense of saying, hey, the church, the Christian church as we know it, has lost its way and needs to be reformed. And Joseph Smith said, actually, it needs a restoration. It needs to be restored. And, you know, we believe that he restored the full teachings of the church. And that's why it's the Church of Jesus Christ and Latter-day Saints. You know, that's the time period that we are now.
Sure.
As you move forward with that, though, with Joseph Smith's death comes a succession crisis. There had been one or two small expressions prior to that. But you get this crisis of this sense of what happens to the church without Joseph Smith, who had been the founder and the driving force of it. There were two main groups, but many other smaller groups as well. You have the ones who believe that Joseph Smith's son should take over the church and that it should be a bloodline. There were those who believed that Brigham Young should be the next leader of the church. As I say, there were also, you know, other expressions that emerge around people like Sidney Rigdon and James Strang and Alpheus Cutler and the Council of 50 and things like that. But there is this brief crisis of what is the future of the church after the first prophet. And so the history and culture of the church, you know, encourages people to believe in personal revelation and prayerful revolution, and so forth. You see that built into the culture of the church from those very early days. And many expressions have emerged because they believe that the modern LDS church has lost its way and that another restoration is needed. For example, they might believe in a return to the gospel as taught by Brigham Young or as taught by Joseph Smith, and want to revert to certain pieces of history or culture or practices or doctrine that belong to that time period.
There's a lot of, and I know that Chad, especially in his books, it's, and I mean, their belief system as a whole, and again, we will get to that particular document shortly, as far as doomsday prophecy, does the official church have any sort of doctrine on doomsday, anything like that? I know that Chad's group, and from what I've seen too, a lot of people from the Mormon community discuss earthquakes, which is why the recent earthquakes, including today, just a couple hours ago in Idaho, get a lot more coverage, I guess, than other things. But have you heard or have you read or been taught anything as far as revelations? Like, is there any sort of kind of similar prophecy there?
Yeah, very much so. In terms of how it ties to the signs of the second coming,
yes,
of Jesus Christ, and so you know what we see in Revelations is something that's commonly taught in the LDS Church: signs of wickedness, war, and turmoil, at times that will be terrifying and dreadful, and that there'll be a lot of suffering on the earth as that comes forward, expecting things like earthquakes and disease and famines and storms. And there's a revelation about hailstorms that will destroy the crops of the earth. So there'd be, you know, mass hunger and starvation, wars and rumors and wars, all of those type of things, this sense of a great destruction. That a common refrain that you'll hear amongst members is, things are going to get worse before they get better. Mm-hmm. So that sense of there are going to be calamities coming and they will steadily get more severe before the second coming, and we need to be prepared for that. And that ties into gospel principles of preparedness and food storage and things like that. And then, of course, we get the groups like Avow that then take it a step further and make that a primary focus.
So I guess let's go to number six then. Ordain individuals to translation as the camps begin.
So I believe that this is talking about translated beings. Mm-hmm. As we mentioned earlier, LDS teaching is that these are incredibly rare circumstances. And a very small number of people who have been translated. It seems to me that Chad and Laurie believe that this will be a much more common thing, and something that they will have personal responsibility for, right? This sounds like they will be the ones, or perhaps Chad will be the one, ordaining individuals, mm-hmm. translating. That is something that is significantly removed from LDS teaching. And one of the things that's interesting with this sense of establishing the presidency of the Church of the Firstborn as well, if that were going to happen within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and someone were to come and say, hey, congratulations, Ian, we'd like to invite you a calling to be part of the Church of the Firstborn, I would expect that to be coming from a senior figure within the organized structure of the church, not from Chad in Salem, Idaho.
I think that ties into, again, into Ian's document when they kind of specify and clarify. It sounds like Chad and Lori will both have the power to do that. To me, as far as the information between and the correspondence between Chad and Lori, ordained individuals to translation almost kind of gives them their first like sense of grandiose and self-importance, I guess.
Really, at that point is where we see that these missions move beyond we need to do things and be part of something and, oh my goodness, people need help and people need feeding and delegating and provide supplies to, oh, and we will ordain people. It suddenly becomes that they will be powerful and influential, and there's a bit of a switch there in terms of how they see themselves.
There is one more on here, and I think you kind of touched on it just a tad, but provide supplies to righteous members of families.
Yeah, that seems to tie back to point five, food distribution as mm-hmm. tribulation starts. note that supplies can mean a lot more than food, and depending on what they think is coming, I mean, could that include hardware? Could that include guns? What else could that cover as supplies? Who knows? The fact that it's restricted to righteous members of families is quite worrisome to me. It's a very exclusive group that they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And if you have a group that is succeeding and thriving, partly because of fear-based doctrine, saying, hey, this is coming, it's going to come soon, doomsday is coming, then saying supplies are going to the righteous members, even righteous members of families, I mean, that's really, I don't know, just how exclusive that is quite troubling to me, and a step away from LDS theology again, where it's about if there's a need, we try to help and we provide, and who is your neighbor? Everybody is thy neighbor, type thinking.
Well, and you just pointed out a good difference there. So speaking of differences between, you know, LDS teachings versus what they believe, what would you say the biggest differences are that you've noticed?
You know, it's hard to know where to start with that, especially without digging into the other documents that we'll talk about, because everything on there with multiple probations and zombies and teleportation portals. No, we'll talk about all of these things later, I'm sure, but none of those things exist in mainstream Mormonism. None of those things are taught by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And in fact, earlier, my wife heard zombies mentioned, and heard it being mentioned that Chad and Laurie believed in zombies, and the eye roll was magnificent. She was dumbfounded that mm-hmm. that could be part of the belief system of anyone connected with Mormonism in any way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a turning point for her. My goodness, these people really are out there.
Well, no, it's true. And it's unfortunate that a lot of people are putting, you know, both belief systems all together online, from what I'm noticing, as far as like, yeah, when that document came out, there were so many people that just thought that was part of it. So that's a good thing to clear up, I think.
One of the things that's interesting there, we do refer to ourselves as being a peculiar people, as Mormons. And, you know, there are things that we do and practices that we believe that are quite different to most people in the world, and that's okay. I also think that if you look at any religion from an outside perspective and from a non-believing perspective, there are all kinds of things that are taken for granted as being normal within that faith or within that denomination that actually seem quite weird when you can distance yourself enough from it to look and say, oh my goodness, that's what you believe happens with the communion, or that's what, you know, this belief means to you and where it comes from. There's something quite strange and peculiar in the belief in the first place that Jesus Christ could be crucified and resurrected and somehow unfathomably perform this great atonement for people's sins to be forgiven. I mean, sure, they're basic Christian beliefs, but actually it's kind of a bit weird, and religion is a bit weird. So I don't mind people saying that, you know, Mormonism is a bit weird. It is. Religion is a bit weird, period.
It is. And then we reach the level of Ian Pawlowski's document. Good things here.
Yeah. Oh boy.
Yeah, this was a fun document.
Yeah, so this document absolutely made my day when it came out. I think that it blew the lid off, for me at least. And I'm sure, I'm not trying to make light of anything, I'm not trying to make fun of anything, but I think a lot of people initially were thinking, oh my God, this is a very dangerous cult. It has, you know, guns and kidnappings and so on and so forth. And not making light, maybe those things are still true. But Ian Pawlowski apparently outlined, via talking to Melanie and Lori and Chad, his time with them, kind of an outline of their belief system. And this mm-hmm. is something that his ex-wife Natalie discovered on the computer. when Ian let her borrow it or gave it to her. And there are some really interesting, weird things on here. So to further kind of clear up the traditional LDS church versus Chad and Lori's group beliefs, if you don't mind, let's just go through this Ian's document and kind of break some of this down.
And I do think it's important to remind ourselves at this stage that we don't know if this document is genuine.
Yes, right?
We don't know that these are the things that Chad and Lori do believe. We know some of them they believe, and it may well be 100% accurate. But some of these things are so strange and unfamiliar to me in terms of expressions of Mormonism that it just gives me pause for thought and wonder, is this genuine? Is it something that Ian concocted, realizing that Chad and Lori were into some crazy stuff and that having got married to Melanie, he'd got himself in over his head and into something he was not expecting at all, and kind of prepared this as a kind of defense document? I think that's quite possible.
That is something that we also discussed, I think, on one of our past episodes. Is
I want to say it was the 20th that we talked about that.
Especially the verbiage in I believe it was his kind of like journal entry or whatever on the computer, where he basically tries to almost completely entirely absolve Melanie of any sort of sinister involvement. So that is a very good point. We are not sure as to the legitimacy or authenticity of these documents. So that is a very good point to bring up. You are absolutely correct. So on that document, and you can read, East Idaho News is like a treasure trove of the actual court documents. So we'll also post a link on our website so you can follow along if you have not seen this. But it starts out number one, multiple probations. Ian, do you just kind of want to discuss and maybe on your own kind of go through the sublines of that?
So multiple probations, sometimes called multiple mortal probations, is a belief in a form of resurrection. And point A says, you know, a minimum of 9 mortal lives to become exalted, more to become gods. There is no concept of multiple probations within LDS theology. The church believes in a kind of linear progression, we might say, that our spirits existed before we're born, before we get a physical body. And then we have this time on earth, and then, you know, there's a post-mortem existence, if you like. But within that, it's the idea that it's the same person, the same life, the same identity as a thread that runs through those 3 phases of life. That was the closest parallel that I could think of to anything that related to multiple probations. This is something that really is quite far removed. Point B talks about after 2 mortal lives being able to choose to sign a light contract or dark contract, but then curiously says that it isn't permanent. And the curious part of me, you know, says, well, who is this signed with if it's not permanent? When can it be changed? Do you have to wait for your next probation and maybe you can sign a different contract then? Could you get partway through a particular probation and say, hey, I don't want to be on the side of light or the side of dark anymore? It raises a lot of interesting kind of esoteric questions and just adds to the strangeness of it, really. And it's that you can choose not to be reborn if you are satisfied with your progress. This is quite interesting to me from the way that it departs from conventional Christian thinking and indeed Mormon thinking, of that sense of we're never going to be perfect, when we should never be satisfied with our progress, because otherwise we wouldn't have need for the atonement. We wouldn't have need for Christ's role as a purifier, as a perfecter, if you like. So the idea of someone stopping and saying, I'm satisfied with my progress now, I don't want to know the probation, seems to me contrary to the fundamental beliefs in Christ. Point D talks about the veil growing thinner each time you are reborn. Have you talked about what the veil means in Mormon theology and what that's talking about? Is that something you'd like me to cover?
If you wouldn't mind, that'd be wonderful.
The basic principle is the idea that we were spirits in the pre-existence, and when we came to Earth and received our bodies, a veil was drawn over so that we don't remember that time before. So the veil growing thinner would be referring to more being remembered, more being known, more being understood. Also, you'll occasionally hear reference to the idea, you know, people on the other side of the veil might try to influence our lives, typically for good, in a place where the veil is thinner, might be referred to as, say, in a holy or sacred place, and might be easier for those people to communicate with us.
As far as the veil, my understanding too was, since Chad had mentioned that he had almost died, does that have any relation to this veil? If you almost die, or like, let's say you died for a certain amount of time and was able to be revived, would that also be like the veil going thinner? If that even makes sense.
It does. Yeah, it does. You do hear people using that kind of terminology for their individual relating of, say, a near-death experience. I wouldn't say that that's officially related to LDS theology, but I think it's something that makes sense to people, that if they've been that close to death but survived, maybe have died and needed their heart restarting, or the, you know, come back from the dead type thing medically. Mm-hmm. Experience that they have, I see how that could tie into that sense of the veil growing thinner, or for that time it being thinner and being able to hear and understand things in a different way. So I think that that can relate to that, to those type of experiences, yes. But I don't think there's something specific teachings that would say that happens. But it's understandable how people could draw that conclusion.
That makes sense. Now, speaking of how it relates to Chad and Lori, letter E under multiple probations, which is multiple ceilings possible, but males can choose one true spouse or have many.
I think that this relates to a form of polygamy. And one of the interesting things watching this case unfold, you know, when you think of Mormonism, one of those hot topic issues in the history of Mormonism has always been polygamy. And so there's kind of a sense of, well, where is that in this story, right? Where is that in this case? Why isn't it there? It's almost a little strange. And I think this is where we find it. If you take the idea of having multiple probations, these multiple mortal lives, then people would be getting married to different people. And the temple covenant of marriage is referred to as a sealing in the LDS Church. Mm-hmm. Family members can also be sealed together and things like that. But it's, you know, the idea of, say, a city hall wedding would be a legal document that applies for this earth. But being married in church, being married in the temple, seals you together with the Lord for all time and eternity. If you haven't found that same person in the next probation, are you being sealed to someone else? So, you know, is this kind of a polygamy through the probation? So if you have 9 mortal lives, are you sealed to 9 different people as your spouse? So a kind of time travel polygamy.
Wow, and that is a phrase that I never thought that I would ever hear in my life. Add that on to the list.
Right.
Which also would be a great band name. I would just like to throw that out there.
Truth. Well, we could keep going then. So I know we hit on this part already, but number 2 is translation.
Yeah, this breaks down what they believe about translated beings. That they can't die, don't need sleep or food. They do not feel the sorrow of the world, which is quite an intense phrase. And I would need to look that up, and I apologize for not already having done that, but I think that that links back to the New Testament and Christ and the atonement. But I would need to reference that and make sure. Curious to me that it's done in phases and tests, lasting 3 days, and you know, this whole description of translation and how it happens. There's nothing in LDS theology that breaks that down. There's nothing that says, and this is the details of how someone comes to be translated or how that comes. So it was quite interesting to me to read this and to see what they believe, but it's far outside of the teachings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Okay, so that point you had just brought up, the translated beings not needing food or sleep, not feeling the sorrow of the world. I want someone to let us know, since Lori supposedly is a translated being, what she is doing in jail. I've seen a lot of people comment on that too. You know, is she eating? Is she sleeping?
Absolutely. I agree. It's bizarre to have someone who, you know, if she believes that she's a translated being and doesn't need these things, you know, how does she explain that she then does those things? And to play devil's advocate for a moment and to try to put myself in that position, I'm not saying I believe this, but if I had to try and prevent that point in a debate, I might say something like, I don't need food or I don't need sleep, but it helps me relate better to other people if I do those things, because then I'm going through similar things that they are.
I mean, yeah, I guess that's true. That could be it.
What about the 50 dark translated humans?
Oh, yeah, that the two people working on the case were dark.
Well, they have to be, right? Because clearly they are. There's obviously no other possible explanation. The two people investigating them must be the forces of darkness sent to thwart their righteous plan. I can't understand why anyone has the slightest hard time in believing that. I never heard of the concept of dark translated beings. The only time in LDS scripture that I've come across translated beings at all is that it is righteous people. I don't know where this comes from or what it means and what to do with that information in terms of understanding them better. Something that's way out there and more than three steps removed from conventional Mormonism.
And one other thing you mentioned earlier, I know that you and I have also discussed this, is the energy healing, the energy work. The next piece on that is vibration. So it's an indication of one's spiritual strength, and then it gives vibration levels. Apparently garments are no longer necessary when you reach around 1,000. Does this particular piece also tie into the energy work, like Reiki and things of that, music, you know, healing and things like that?
It appears to. Vibration is not a term that we find in conventional LDS teachings. It's not a term that you find in the scriptures or in conference talks or in the words of the prophets. It's something that does seem to come from, you know, more New Age beliefs and things that have been welded on Mormonism here.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that is kind of like an injection of more New Age spirituality rather than traditional teaching.
Yeah, definitely. It's not a term or an expression that you'll find within the teachings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Excellent. And then we have the piece that made headlines and everyone is talking about. Zombies.
Yeah, I mentioned before, you know, my wife's reaction on hearing the term used, zombie, that, you know, you could see this look on her face that was just, I have no idea how this could in any way possibly relate to Christianity or Mormonism or anything else. Mm-hmm. Now, do we believe that spiritual possession can happen? Yes. And there are examples in the Bible where it talks about that. Is that something that's commonplace and something that we normally talk about and that we think about happening? No. It's another of those pieces of possession of itself that tends to be, you know, something that's just sort of skipped over. And you know it's mentioned there in the New Testament, but don't spend a lot of time, you know, focused on it or thinking about it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just that sheer sense of possession, sure. The understanding that this document claims to have of what that means, of how spirits are pushed from bodies and then trapped in limbo because the body is still living, but their spirit can't occupy it anymore. Mm-hmm. All of this is completely unfamiliar to me and completely outside of LDS theology.
I wonder if it's just, I mean, I'm not even going to go into speculation town, but, you know, part of me wonders if it's just a way and method for, and Chad in particular, but also Lori, obviously, members of this group to identify people who oppose them, you know, quote unquote enemies and the like. That's
part of what's interesting about that is that they have two different ways of identifying that, right? Mm-hmm. Because zombies aren't the same as the 50 dark translated humans. Mm-hmm. So for some reason, they have two groups of enemies that they're concerned about. And I think that that suggests a level of paranoia and insecurity, that they are thinking so much about what are the opposing forces and who are they and how can we explain them and label them.
Another thing that I have been seeing everywhere based off of this document too is, I'm going to put 5 and 6 together because I feel like they kind of go hand in hand. Teleportation and then dark and light portals.
Yeah, this is that kind of awkward moment where I just sort of stare at the screen a little blankly. And the first time I read the document, it just has that moment of that sense of that it's so far removed and off the rails from LDS teachings that I don't quite know what to do with it or what to say other than, you know, this is nothing to do with the teachings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and nothing to do with expressions of Mormonism that I've come across in the past. I am fascinated as a curious person to know where this comes from. But it's very strange and unfamiliar to me. And that's the best I can really say.
Honestly, that's probably for the best.
It makes them sound more like, you know, members of the X-Men.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And just everything I've seen on this part of the document, at least, I've seen all of the jokes about how they just portal to each other when they need to meet up. So, yeah, that one's a little far-fetched.
But now, hang on. This is a convenient way around prison visitation rules.
It truly is.
I do rather enjoy the memes that have surfaced. There are multiple case meme groups, and all they do is share memes. And, you know, obviously some of them are very, very tasteless, but I love the portal ones. I absolutely live for them.
They're my fave.
Yes.
Well, and it's that kind of off topic, but that Twitter that someone made at Lori Vallow, and just that she doesn't miss Chad because he visits her at night.
So someone on Twitter made a fake Lori Vallow account, just like, you know, there's one for God, or my ultimate favorite, Helen Keller, is also on Twitter, but someone made one for Lori Vallow, and it is just it's comedy brilliance. But I digress.
It's one of the really awkward moments for me from that sense of, you know, I really try not to mock people's beliefs too heavily, you know, especially sincerely held beliefs, and then I read something like this and I struggle to know what else to do. And I think it's good that we're able to find a bit of humor in what is a very, very dark case.
That's true.
And that is something too. You know, there are at the core of this, we have two missing children that no one has seen or heard from since September. And then we also have Tammy, whose death is suspicious, to put it lightly. We have Charles Vallow, who I personally believe suffered great injustice in the way that the Chandler Police mm-hmm. Department handled the investigation, even into a shooting of quote-unquote self-defense. And then, right. you know, potentially even before that with Joseph Ryan as well, the Lori's husband pre-Chad Charles Vallow. So Ian's exactly right. You know, at the core of this, this is a very, very, very dark and just devastating, devastating case. It all keeps getting stranger and stranger.
I think that the more immersed you get into what is a very serious and dark case, the more psychologically it's important to be able to find something you can laugh at, something you mm-hmm. can smile about, even if it's conventionally inappropriate.
Absolutely.
And I find myself laughing at some of these things, but feeling a little bad about it at the same time.
Absolutely.
But we have to be able to laugh, or when you're so immersed in a case like this, it will drive you a little crazy if you can't find some kind of release.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And thank you also for pointing that out. That is very, very true. Another piece that I found really interesting is that underneath the Church of the Firstborn is that doctrines, quote, add to but do not replace those of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So I found it personally interesting that they said add to but do not replace. I don't know why that one particularly stuck with me.
I'm really glad you mentioned this. I think this is one of the most important points in the document. You know, it's very ingrained in the LDS Church, a fear of becoming apostate or falling away and being anti-church. So here you have, apparently, a group that is teaching supplementary things. And there are people who would be afraid to join an expression or to belong to something outside of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And they'd be afraid. One reason would be that they'd be concerned that they were putting their eternal salvation at risk, that they would be risking the promise of eternal life with families sealed together and happiness ever after by stepping away from the church. So this strikes me as really significant because it's the kind of thing that someone might say if you wanted to convince someone that joining your expression is okay with the church, that this is not something apostate. This is not something anti-Mormon. This is not something you'd get in trouble for. It doesn't replace any of those doctrines. It's just something extra that you were special privileged to know about. Mm-hmm. No, and that emphasis of the prophet of the Mormon church presides over the general congregation while others are specifically to run the Church of the Firstborn. Again, it kind of says you're special. Mm-hmm. You're extra. You have something that's a bonus, and that you were more important than you know. And I can hear how that could be quite a seductive sales pitch, that on the one hand is reassuring, you won't get in trouble for coming with us because it doesn't replace any of those LDS doctrines. You won't get in trouble, and you are special mm-hmm. because we invite you to do this and you're invited to be part of this. Mm-hmm. But then you have the sinister part. We start looking at this case and we're thinking, this is just Chad and Lori. Mm-hmm. This is a family tragedy. And then multiple branches throughout the world, you suddenly sit back and go, oh, this is not just Chad and Lori. Mm-hmm. Who else? How many are there? You know, how large is this group? And that's part of why I asked the question about those other expressions that go by the Church of the Firstborn and if there's any connection there. And I don't know that there is or isn't, but it just makes me wonder about that and other expressions and if, you know, they have joined something that already existed versus being something new.
Mm-hmm. And they definitely bring up as well in this document the fact that this their particular group is responsible for music and kind of energy healing, right? Mm-hmm. So it seems, you know, obviously it's pure speculation, but the verbiage in the document indicates that this is just one group of multiple, of a greater
whole. Right, I wonder,
yeah,
what are the other ones?
Right, so that is scary.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other one, or the next one then, 8, is Dark Church and Priesthood.
You know, this talks about Satan as God's exact opposite. And there is some complicated and more obscure LDS theology that kind of relates to this. And in Christian teaching as well, you know, the idea that Lucifer leads a war in heaven and causes a third of the host to be cast out and so forth. No, that's not God's exact opposite, but there is this concept there of being in opposition, and in LDS teaching of there being two plans presented, that Lucifer presented a plan that would be, he would make sure that everybody was exalted at the end and everybody was saved. He would make sure of it, and people wouldn't have independent thinking and what we call agency to make their own decisions, because he would make sure everybody got through. And Christ presented a different plan that is, you know, what survives as conventional LDS teaching of what we believe is happening today, and the, you know, the atonement and the resurrection and, you know, Christ's role in our lives. And the idea is that those two plans are presented, and 2/3 of the host, you know, said, hey, we want to follow Christ's plan, and that Lucifer then leads a rebellion, and the 1/3 that supported him are then cast out and don't get to receive bodies. And it's a very, you know, dramatic war in heaven that stems there from the Bible and those scriptures.
Sure.
And it seems like this is something that has been pulled out of that and taken in a different direction. We also see here talk about Cain being the first dark being to be translated. Mm-hmm. And I this is where I get really confused and stuck for words, because I just don't know where this kind of thing comes from. And the fact that they have a set number of 50 dark translated beings, you know, why 50? Where do they come up with that number? Why is it hard restricted to 50? Or is it there are 50 so far, but in a year, maybe there are another 5? Mm-hmm. I don't know. This is such unfamiliar territory, but it's nothing to do with the teachings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Mm-hmm. So number 9 is spiritual gifts/powers.
So as members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we do believe that people have spiritual gifts, or can have spiritual gifts. And these are things that are pretty commonly found within a wide variety of Christian traditions, you know. Things like the gift of tongues, or the translation of tongues, which is the ability to sometimes speak in an alien language. Now, in some Christian churches, that's something that happens fairly regularly, that, you know, in public meetings or worship meetings, people may be speaking in tongues and then someone translates it. It's very rare that that comes up in the LDS church, and it doesn't tend to come up in that kind of a way. But sure, we believe that spiritual gifts exist. I mean, we believe that with God, all things are possible. And there is something supernatural about that, right? Not necessarily sinister, but that sense of supernatural meaning, things that happen that can't be exist through conventional, natural, normal means, right? So the atonement and the resurrection can be described as supernatural in that sense. They're not things that should and would normally happen. We believe that God, our Heavenly Father, is omnipotent and could do anything. So we believe in that potential and possibility. when we hear it described as people can manipulate the elements to do the Lord's will, again, it does sound more X-Men territory than, say, somebody can speak fluent French when they need to, when yesterday they only knew three words of French, which is the type of gift of tongues example more likely to come up in an LDS situation.
Okay. So, like, as far as the manipulating the elements, was it Alex and his wife were, what was the words that they used, Robin?
Preparing earthquakes. Does that register any significance to you as far as, like, terminology, preparing earthquakes?
That's not something that you'll find in mainstream Mormonism or in the teachings of the LDS Church. This is one example, though, where I query the wording, and are we taking it too literally? Preparing earthquakes. So, Robin, I know you love Tori Amos the same way that I do.
Yes.
Little earthquakes.
Yes.
Earthquakes can be personal. They can be spiritual. They can be emotional. They can be all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's easy to assume that they're referring to geology and mm-hmm. earthquakes and the strata of the earth and moving plates. Mm-hmm. There have been many what we can describe as earthquakes in history that didn't involve the land, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The civil rights movement was an earthquake in terms of the seismic change it brought to our society mm-hmm. or has started to bring to us. There are a multitude of things that we can talk about as being earthquakes where we're not actually talking about the land. So I wonder, is it possible that knowing that doomsday is coming, that I know when they're talking about preparing earthquakes, they might not have been talking about the land. They might be thinking about something that will shock people and wake people up.
Interesting.
That actually hits home. And putting it in reference in context with Tori Amos was a complete win. No, that makes sense.
And just that line of hers, if I may, doesn't take much to rip us to pieces. It was always something that pulled really hard on me. You know, the straw that breaks the camel's back, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. You can feel that you're coping and then something happens and pulls the rug from out on you. And even on a smaller scale, you know, if you're going through a really hard time, you're keeping it together. It can be the smallest thing that just breaks you that day and your composure's gone. And that kind of little earthquake that was just such a powerful moment from Tori Amos for me. And something that resonated so hard that I couldn't help but think of that in the context here. What does it take to wake people up? What does it take to cause people to think about things differently? What kind of earthquakes can that be? Yes, mm-hmm. it may be tectonic. It may be talking about plates and the earth, but it may be talking about a completely different kind of influence on people to help them understand that the end times are coming.
That's an absolute amazing perspective on that, because we were absolutely taking it 100% literally as far as physical tectonic plate and movements. And no, that's an amazing perspective. And I don't think that's one that we would have come to and arrived on our own about. I think we were just so literal about all of this that I never even thought to go there.
I am thoroughly amused that it took a Mormon citing Tori Amos to get us to the different possible interpretation of Chad Daybell. I mean, they're just three points of the triangle that you would never expect to intersect. I mean, it would be like if I suddenly started talking about Harry Potter. You just wouldn't think it would come into, oh, wait, what are we talking about now?
Well, that leads, you know, to number 10 on the document. If you can imagine it, it's real. So every fantastic idea is a reality of somewhere. According to them, wizards, sorcerers, witches, etc. If you can think it, it is real. So therefore, you know, supernatural creatures, vampires, dragons, giants, it could also be real. So this number 10 is just out of this entire document. It's kind of you get to everything. You're like, okay, this is weird. This is really weird. And then you arrive at number 10. What is this? Like, where did this come from?
Well, I'm sorry. I'm trying to take this seriously.
I don't think number 10 can be taken seriously.
No, I do have a couple of points to make about it, though. It's just hard to focus. It's hard to have that great focused will to be able to talk about it seriously. No, so when it says these things in Harry Potter are real, mm-hmm. I keep hearing it being said, and they believe in Harry Potter, which is not quite the same thing, right? What they're saying is some of the things that are depicted mm-hmm. in Harry Potter are real. Mm-hmm. Now, that ties in more to me with different forms of, you know, dark magic and things, but you know, we can see how that does connect to different belief systems and different forms of theology. Mm-hmm. And if we think of a kind of every force has an opposite, if we believe in blessings, if we believe in ways that powers can be used for good, then there's a negative to that as well, right? That probably could exist, and sure. maybe that's what they're talking about. Let me also throw on there, when we talk about supernatural creatures, I mean, these exist in all kinds of mythology and have done for millennia, for the whole history of mankind, and they come from somewhere or something. We even have a giant of a type in the Old Testament when we talk about David and Goliath. So is this something that's meant to be read literally? Or is it something that will be a surprise? What is talked about in mythology as centaurs, these are the horseback riders that after the collapse of civilization, with all these terrible dark events of the second coming, the horseback riders come racing through with supplies so that people have got enough to eat and drink and save the day. And they look like centaurs because it's a man on a horse. I'm stretching. I'm really stretching here and reaching. But are those things possible? Maybe.
Well, they even just say the idea is a reality somewhere. So even if it's maybe just a piece of one of these topics that can be traced somewhere that is real in some fashion. Now, the second part, though, spells and curses in Harry Potter are real. That's the part that I'm like, I really don't think it is real. I wish it was.
Well, there are many things in this document I don't think are real. And the question is more, do Chad and Laurie think it's real? And that's possible. We go back to, we don't know if this document is authentic or if it's a fair representation of their beliefs. But is it possible they believe this? I mean, sure.
Exactly. And also to that point, too, you know, let's just, you know, say for a moment that the legitimacy of this document is real. We don't know if Ian, you know, typed it up at 2 a.m. after learning these things days before, missed things or misinterpreted things. You know, all of that is totally up in the air too.
Right. Any sense of context is missing. And it's not the person who said these things who wrote this document.
Right.
And so you may be account the bearers. One other point, if I may, on the supernatural creatures, that's interesting to me. So much of what's in scripture is written as allegory. So many times metaphor is used. Mm-hmm. How many times have you heard someone, and typically in a misogynistic way, a woman, referred to as a dragon? You know, when somebody is really mad and they come screaming and hollering like they're breathing fire and just coming at you, you know? It used to be a staple of stand-up comedy jokes, referring to the mother-in-law as a dragon, right? So there is room for metaphor in all of these things, and room for Chad and Laurie to be able to say, you know, this is what it means. And this is what Ian wrote down, but what it really means, what it's really talking about is a metaphor for there are some people who will stand tall like a giant. There are some people who you won't want to get into an argument with because their words can breathe fire on you mm-hmm. and just, you know, destroy what you're trying to say that's in opposition. There are people who will be mounted riders on horses who will come in and, you know, have a heroic save the day moment. All those types of things. There is a possible way that it could mean something that is not as fantastical as it looks at first glance. Or it could be a lot of folklore nonsense piled on top of nonsense on top of something else that has a hint of a strain of something that was a sincere belief somewhere else.
No, that makes sense in interpret.
This is the challenge that we have so little information to go off with this document and Chad's 7 missions. And we're trying to understand a complex belief system based on these 2 short documents, one of which wasn't even written by Chad or Laurie. And so we're trying to take these nuggets. We're all trying to make some sense of it. And we just don't have enough information to have a confident knowledge of what any of it really means.
That's very true. And just the final piece is spiritual healing, which healing malachite solution or balm. Malachite is said to have healing properties, which I'm pretty sure most everyone is aware of based on, you know, energy healing. More New Age theology is very much into the crystals and energy. And any additional things to add there, Ian, as far as just the malachite and the spiritual healing aspect?
Yeah. Because we are seeing that term energy healing pop up quite a lot. That is not something that part of LDS theology or teaching directly. But faith healing is. And, you know, that sense of laying on of hands and giving someone a blessing, the idea being that the priesthood holder, you know, giving that blessing receives inspiration through the Holy Spirit of what Heavenly Father wants the person to hear, and may include a physical hearing. And there are many anecdotes that people share of miraculous healings that they believe have happened to them or someone they know or somebody they've heard of or so forth. And, you know, what is the difference between faith healing and energy healing other than perhaps the religious context? I think that's the primary difference. So it's a no on energy healing, but that principle of faith healing, of the laying on of hands, is a core LDS doctrine and belief.
So we are going to stop right here for now and continue next week with the remainder of the Ian Pawlowski document, as well as just other questions that people have had in the forums or have emailed to us generically about the Mormon faith and certain tenets or doctrines that may be relevant to this case.
All right. Well, I learned a ridiculous amount tonight. I don't know how you feel.
No, I feel the same. Like, mind blown.
So I have a list of questions that I want to continue to ask him already, jotted down. If you have anything that is just bugging you that you want to understand, let us know. We do have a lot of questions already written down, but we may be able to add it.
Yes. And as always, if you have any questions, concerns, complaints, compliments, anything of that nature, feel free. You can email us at wesawthedevil@gmail.com. And we always like hearing from you.
We do. And we do read all of your comments, too. Sometimes it takes us a couple days to respond to them, but we do read everything. So thank you for everyone all over. So Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, we love all your comments. So thank you guys so much for the support.
Yes, thank you. So that wraps it up for this week. Again, check out our Patreon. Please make sure, if you like our content, to leave us a review on iTunes. Rate and review is the biggest thing that you can do to support us. We would really appreciate it. And Amanda, do you have anything else?
No, stay inside and be safe.
Stay inside, be safe, wash your hands, and don't touch your face. Until next crime.